there are 1.7 billion people in the world that have a job but no bank account. And these people are still being paid in cash. And they are excluded from the basic financial services that you and I take for granted. There's 200 million businesses in the world that still rely completely on cash payments to their employees, to contractors, and to their suppliers. And that's obviously a massive opportunity. That's an opportunity that caught my attention, and through different iterations, I've worked on those opportunities.
I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of the world of investment by focusing on its people and their stories. I'm joined today by Frans van Aerssel, who's the CEO and founder of DoPay, a payments company headquartered in London with a primary market of Egypt, where he lived for 4 years. He has had a long career in industry and is also CEO of Driver's Seat Investment. Welcome, Frans. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. And thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with your background and career journey. Can you talk us through where you grew up, what you studied, and how you ended up in this career?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, Frans van Aerssel. I grew up in the Netherlands, so hence my accent. Went to high school, went to Tilburg University, studied business economics, got a master's in strategic and international management. Started my career in the textile industry with a American company, in fact, that was active in textile identification organization. Stayed there for 5 years. And then went into banking, joined a part of ING Bank, which was a company that was active in the chip card industry. After a few years, that division was acquired by an American company called ACI Worldwide, which is very well known in the industry, in the payments industry, for its payment engines. And then about 20 years ago now, I started my first venture. And that's where I got exposed to Egypt. So through that venture called the Inclusion Group, we aimed to build interbanking payment systems, which we did in Egypt. And then, 6 years ago or so, I started DoPay. I'm there since. So yeah, that's my career. Like I said, born in the Netherlands, but since a while living abroad. So in 2007, I moved to Cairo, lived there for 4 years. After that, 8 years London, and then 9 months Cairo again. And for the last 2 years, I live in Abu Dhabi, but still travel a lot. So that's it in a nutshell.
Well, certainly payments have been a theme for many decades, it seems, there. I'd love to talk about the problem perhaps that DoPay is designed to solve, because when I think about startups, I sort of think about it with that frame. Can you tell us a little bit about what it does and how you came about the idea?
Yeah, so when I was part of ING Bank, I was quite close with a division within ING, was advising basically governments and postal organizations around retail banking. So I'm not sure if you know the history of ING, but ING in the beginning, it basically was a merger of SME Bank and Postbank, and that became ING. And they always have served a huge part of the Dutch population. So more than 50% of the people in Holland, they had an account with ING. And they obviously used the post offices as a transaction center because it was one of the first banks that didn't have their own branches, right? So they used the post offices where you could walk in and deposit money and do some transactions, but mostly it was a direct bank. And that obviously was a very, very successful concept, and it got a lot of attention from emerging and developing countries. And at that time, we're speaking in the year 2000 or so, the post offices in these markets were still the most dense networks that existed in these countries. And for me, what was super intriguing was that, like I said, I'm born in the Netherlands, and my parents already opened a savings account for me when I was born. And I've always grown up with the concept of having a bank account and with payments. And then you learn that there are so many people that are unbanked despite having a job. So that really got my interest, and that changed the direction of my career, so to speak. It's the beginning of my career in payments, fintech, and emerging markets, or if you would like to say financial inclusion. Yeah, and the opportunity is massive. Even today, as we speak, there are 1.7 billion people in the world that have a job but no bank account. And these people are still being paid in cash. And they are excluded from the basic financial services that you and I take for granted. There's 200 million businesses in the world that still rely completely on cash payments to their employees, to contractors, and to their suppliers. And that's obviously a massive opportunity. That's an opportunity that caught my attention. And through different iterations, I've worked on those opportunities.
It's so interesting. I'd love to now talk a little bit, or have you paint a picture of the opportunity in Egypt. Because we hear a lot about Kenya, for example, being the mobile payments capital of the world, that it has essentially leapfrogged many other countries, perhaps because of this lack of infrastructure you mentioned, because of the lack of tradition of banking, maybe for everyone. What's the opportunity in Egypt in particular?
Well, the opportunity in Egypt is, first of all, you have 110 million people there, right? And about 60%, 65% of these people are still unbanked. And yes, Kenya, obviously, we know because of Vodafone Cash, where people got wallets. But that is something that didn't really kick off in Egypt. Yes, you have wallets, and nowadays there are many, many millions. However, the average balance that's kept in a wallet is very, very minimal. And there is a why it is, because if you're still being paid in cash, why would you load your salary on a wallet? You will only load that amount that you deem necessary to make certain transactions. So the opportunity for us was to change that model and start breaking the cash cycle at the corporate. So that is what we do with DoPay. We basically go to companies and provide them with a platform that allows them to instantly open accounts for the employees. And these employees get a prepaid debit card that they can use to take money out of an ATM or to make payments in shops or even online. And that is what we are doing. So we have taken a different route. And that route is not so different from the country where I come from. So going back to ING, to Postbank, that bank became big in the 60s and 70s by offering salary accounts to government employees and later to the private sector. And basically what we are doing is the same, but we do it obviously with the latest technology that's available, right? And that makes it cheaper. That makes it also possible to serve these kind of people because the salaries are substantially lower, obviously. So you get the employees that we serve, their average salary is about $300 a month, right? So that's obviously completely different from salaries that are being made in the US or Europe. So you can only serve these people in an effective way if you have a technology and a platform that is cost effective.
And given you are tackling the SME sector at the employer level, which is probably quite a fragmented sector, quite a lot of small entities, how do you sell your services to them? Is it kind of blocking and tackling, a series of Salesforce, or do you do it through social media? How do you penetrate the employers there?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So if you look at the Egyptian banks, basically what they do, they have people on the street and they knock on doors and try to sell the service. That's something we don't do. So we fully rely on inbound marketing. Are very active on social media, on paid channels like Facebook, Google, LinkedIn, Instagram. And we try to get their attention. And they become a lead. And once they become a lead, we contact them. And we try to offer the service. And for us, that's working really well. Again, it's a way to be cost effective. Because what is interesting in our model is that when we get an SME, that SME has, let's say, 25 or 50 people. We spread the customer acquisition cost over those 25 to 50 people, and that makes it attractive for us.
Understood. You've certainly highlighted some of the key differences in doing business in Egypt. What would you say some of the challenges you faced have been in doing business in Africa, but also the opportunities as well?
How long do you have?
we can touch on the highlights and the lowlights.
I mean, look, the opportunity is massive, right? And Egypt, like I said, there is 110 million people, and still a minority of these people are being served. And even the people that are being served are not being served well, in my opinion. So the opportunity itself is massive. It's untapped. The challenge is that there's obviously a reason why it's untapped. And decision-making is very slow in the country. Sometimes it takes for ages. Something that I'm used to doing 5 minutes can take 5 weeks, right? So you have to be really resilient. You have to find your ways, how to convey the message. There's a lot of obstacles that you have to overcome. But we believe, and I think we prove, that once you go over the obstacles and you build something that is really solid, you have an opportunity to offer these kind of services. Because in general, the expectation of the people around services is very, very low. So if you stand out and you can't exceed their expectations, people are very surprised and very happy to deal with you. So the opportunity is massive, obviously, because of the numbers, but the challenges are the same. A lot of things don't work the way how you would like them to work. But again, that's the opportunity. That's why we are there. That's why we try to change it. But you have to be resilient, right? You have to be in there for the long term.
And in terms of getting backing for DuPay and looking for financial backing for investors, are you generally looking outside Africa? And I'd love to know how the African opportunity is perceived from your standpoint.
Yeah, so most of our investors are indeed from outside Africa, outside Egypt, or outside the Middle East. And somebody once said in the Middle East to me that the reason why I didn't get investors from the region so much as others is because I'm not bluffing enough, right? So that's a little bit the nature. There is a lot of stories. There's a lot that is being said there. But financial services, you have to build something solid, right? Because in the end, you're dealing with money of people. So trust is super important. And I found that the model that we have and the story itself very much resonated with investors in Europe and in the US, because they have been through it. We have a lot of bankers on our cap table that themselves work on a lot of these opportunities 10 years ago, 20 years ago in Europe and the US. So they recognize the opportunity, and they also understand that it takes a little bit of time to build out that infrastructure. So yeah, that's why we have a lot of these investors. I think we expect that now things are really starting to scale at our end. We will get more local investors as well, but still we're quite keen to bring in investors from Europe and US, because the way how companies are being scaled in these markets, there's just so much to learn from that, and to bring that to Africa is super important, right? That knowledge still until today, I think it's not there to that large extent. So it's really good to have European and US backers to bring that knowledge to the continent.
It's really interesting. I think there are certain investors who've always seen the opportunity in Africa and have been investing for some time. And then there's a whole other segment for whom it's too frontier. I wonder, with the changes in emerging markets as we're seeing it, certainly Russia coming off the investable list, and maybe also China coming off the investable list, even though ironically China has a lot of interest in Africa, whether this will present Africa in a better light or not, it's interesting.
It's a massive market, right? And you're talking about basic services, in our case, basic financial services. And I always say having a bank account is a basic human right, right? Because just imagine your life without a bank account. It makes it super expensive, right? If you have to do everything in cash and you have to pay your bills in cash, you're spending so much time on your financial services, let alone when you become sick or ill and you don't have any insurance to cover you, that can bring dramas to families, right? So there is a massive need for these services, and that's what we see. right? You just have to find the right model. You have to be sure that you find the right partners. And in our case, obviously, we are working in a regulated environment. So that is something that we have seen that the regulators also have to learn. And they are used to work with banks, and now they work with fintechs, which makes them sometimes a little bit nervous that they are operating in a regulated space. So that took some time, but the opportunity is so massive with basic financial services, and the numbers are so big that I think the risk is relatively low, particularly the ones that really make it. And you can certainly pick the winners after a certain year. So I think that you would be silly not to look at these opportunities, because the return that you can make there will probably be a multitude of what you can make in other markets.
We will have to get you back for a whole other podcast on the assessing creditworthiness and the kind of dynamics of whether it be micro lending as well as this financial inclusion, because clearly it's not just a problem in Africa. It's also a problem even in the US here where I am. So definitely a huge topic there. I just want to return to some personal reflections now just to close us out. As you've had this long career in financial services, including a lot of early introduction to payments and fintech, were there any key people there who were mentors to you or whose work style had an influence on you?
Oh my God, so many, right? So let me think. I mean,
it doesn't have to be an exhaustive list. I always should say that because people feel that they leave someone out.
Yeah. I mean, look, I've always read a lot, but there's two books that stood out for me that influenced me. One is Prahalad and Hamel, and they had a book, it's called Competing for the Future. And it came in a time where Michael Porter was very popular, but he looked at certain industries, right? And these guys came and he said, look, you can create your own industry. You should not look at an industry, because by competing for the future, you can create your own industry. They have been so right, right? If you look back the last 20, 30 years, complete new industries have been created that we've never heard of or we never imagined they would emerge. So that had a big impact on how I looked at my career, that I can create my own destiny. Your book is Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I think everybody should read that. It had a big influence on me. So interesting enough, my first job, I started with that company in an internship, and I used to have coffee with the managing director there in the morning. And I was a student, so I knew everything better because I read the books and all of that. So I was giving a lot of free advice. And then they gave me the opportunity to work there. And I remember that on the first day that I started working there, I started again with giving all kind of advice. And the guy was silent. And he was silent for 30 seconds, and it was so uncomfortable. And then I realized, I have to stop talking. I have to be proactive. And that moment has been so pivotal for me, that you have the opportunity to be proactive, to create things. So I was also very lucky to be in Techstars, which is an accelerator. And one of the great things that I learned there, and the one that was managing the program for us, was Greg Rogers. Storytelling. Tell your story in the right way and you get the attention of people. That in itself has been an absolute game changer for me. I came out of that program. I told my story about DuPay completely different, and suddenly everybody wanted to invest. And before that program, I suffered. It is one of these key moments in my life. Yeah. But I can't go on. There's many, many more people that helped me and where we are today.
Well, not only have you mentioned some great people, you've thrown in wonderful words of wisdom there as well. My final question is usually around those words of wisdom or any kind of creed or motto that you live by. You've touched on a few. If you were to maybe give advice to your younger self or to come up with one or two, what would you say?
Again, it's not coming from me, but I think it's so true. I think in general, people overestimate what can be done in 1 year and they underestimate what can be done in 10. You have to dream, you have to be proactive, and you have to be persistent. And particularly when you're working in Africa, there is not a clear road to success. You have so many roadblocks that you have to remove, and you have to be persistent in achieving your objectives and achieving your vision. And for that, you have to also surround yourself with the right people. you need mentors. You constantly need mentors. And by the way, these mentors will change over time, right? You absorb their wisdom and constantly you learn from people. Listening is super, super important.
Well, thank you so much, Franz. This has been a very energizing discussion. As you know, I spent time in Egypt just this year and was incredibly invigorated by that opportunity. And I see you really as existing on many different frontiers, bearing in mind that the frontier is not a place that many people want to be. I see you on the frontier of fintech and financial innovation. I see you on the frontier of the essential area of financial inclusion, and also on the literal frontier, the geographic frontier in Africa, and bringing great change and impact there. So thank you so much for coming here and for sharing your insights with us.
You're most welcome. And thank you again for having me.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring investors and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.